are you all this morning?
Thank you. Great.
You had a little bit of a drive, or I guess a flight?
My residence is in Little Rock, so I drove down here last time.
I see.
I understand it's icing and snowing up there today.
Yeah, weather's always a problem in January and February, or it can be. All right, this morning we only have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket and one case on our 10:30 docket. We'll go through the first two cases. The first one, McDonald versus Harris Methodist.
Hey, please, the court, Mr. Mark Stewart, will represent the appellant, and Lynn Burns will represent the appellee.
All right, thank you, Mr. Stewart.
Your Honors, I wanted to let the court know that this is my first appeal that I have ever argued in my career. My name is Mark Stewart. I am my office is in Houston. My residence is in Little Rock. Recently moved up there, but I've handled medical malpractice cases for many years now, and I've been lucky enough never to have to go and appeal anything. So this is my first oral argument, my first brief that I've written of, actually my second brief of this kind. But I apologize in advance for any flaws that I may have committed in my brief or in this argument. This is a medical malpractice case underlying. It's a very complex medical malpractice case, both in the background of the procedure and also the medicine involved. Essentially, what is at issue with this appeal is not so much the law and precedents and things like that, but more the facts that were presented with regards to proximate cause in the depositions and other data that was before the court. The issue is whether the trial court underneath us correctly granted a motion for summary judgment in favor of the defendant hospital in this case with regards to whether or not the plaintiff produced more than a mere scintilla of evidence regarding proximate cause. Given the complex facts, I'll try to make this as simple as possible. At age 44, Walter McDonald, he was a husband and father of four, presented to Harris Methodist HEB Hospital with chest pain, and within a few hours was diagnosed correctly as suffering from an aortic dissection. The aorta is the largest artery in the body. It exits the top of the heart, curves back down, and goes back through the middle of the guts down towards your internal organs and eventually splits and goes into your legs. He had a dissection of the aorta. That's a tear from the inside of the aorta. Obviously, a life-threatening type kind of thing. If it comes apart, you bleed out within minutes internally, crushes your heart, and you die. John Ritter died of this and several other people that you may have heard of. There are two types. There's type A and type B. Type A is a dissection or a tear on the ascending portion of the aorta. That's the portion just past the heart on the way up before it curves back down. Type B is on the way back down. This patient had a type B dissection. Type A dissections require immediate surgical correction if you can get to them in time at all. Type B requires, and every expert in this case, including former defendant Dr. Carter, the heart surgeon, he and all the other experts agree that surgery is not absolutely necessary immediately upon diagnosis of a type B dissection. Instead, the preference is to manage the patient medically by giving them medications and monitoring them, trying to reduce their blood pressure and the pounding of the heart. That reduces the load on the aorta as it descends.
Exactly what kind of doctor Dr. Carter was?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor. Cardiothoracic surgeon. I believe he's also qualified as a cardiovascular surgeon. They overlap a great deal. The plaintiff's expert in this case is a cardiovascular surgeon, cardiothoracic surgeon, lots of other things as well.
Dr. Fly? Dr. Fly?
That's right.
Okay.
Dr. Wayne Fly from WashU in St. Louis. Dr. David Conte was Dr. Carter's cardiothoracic surgery expert at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, just for clarity. Anyway, what's at issue in this case is at some point, Walter McDonald, during the 4 or 5 days that he was alive and in the hospital, developed problems that required immediate surgical intervention. And the crux of the case is whether they should have done the surgery sooner rather than later, right? Well, I've said so far that you don't have to surgically intervene with type B dissections unless, and every expert and every doctor has agreed with this, you find evidence of metabolic acidosis in the patient. Metabolic acidosis is an elevated amount of carbon dioxide in the blood. It means, it tells the doctor that blood is not getting to some end organs down in your lower guts, maybe your small bowel, your colon, your kidneys, maybe even your leg, and it is beginning to die for lack of oxygen. And it becomes ischemic, and it begins to throw off carbon as part of that process. It enters your blood. That raises your blood pH. That means you're acidotic. And if blood is not getting down there, that means the dissection is tearing down further or doing something terrible to the perfusion. And so surgery is needed. So when did metabolic acidosis raise its ugly head in this case? He was admitted on Friday. He was diagnosed on Friday. Saturday, there were some intermittent signs, but not enough to warrant surgery. Sunday, the same. All experts have agreed, even the plaintiff's expert. Monday night, there's actually two times when the nurses could have found metabolic acidosis and alerted Dr. Carter, the surgeon in this case. One was Monday night, and one was early Tuesday morning. For time's sake, I'm just going to focus on the Monday night, because it helps my case better, because it gives us more time to surgically correct the patient, okay? On Monday night at about 9 o'clock, after all the doctors had gone home, this patient started developing something called tachypnea. Tachypnea is an elevated respiratory rate. A respiratory rate far above what is normal, and it's chronic, extended, not for a few minutes. About 9 o'clock Monday night, the patient started essentially panting in bed. Like that. That is evidence of his body trying to blow off carbon dioxide that's building up in his blood, metabolic acidosis. That's not just what I say, but that's what Dr. Carter has said in his testimony. That's what Dr. Hamm, the general surgery expert for Dr. Carter, has agreed with in this case. That's what the plaintiff's expert has said, Dr. Fly, in this case. That was the first sign of metabolic acidosis. At that time, what should have been done is the nurses should have called Dr. Carter and alerted him. He's the surgeon. He's the one that makes the surgery decision, not a cardiologist, not a nephrologist, certainly not a nurse. Dr. Carter needed to know about that. The whole purpose of him being in the hospital and being monitored is to watch out for metabolic acidosis in case.
Let me ask a question, though. The defense response, though, is, well, that doesn't matter even if it was Monday night or then early Tuesday morning when the lab results came back. Because there was nothing in, I guess, Dr. Carter's testimony that he would have operated immediately. So how do we get over that hurdle?
The thing that I believe confused the trial court in this case is that Dr. Carter's deposition was taken before this tachypnea was found buried in the nursing records later in discovery. So he was not asked specifically that question, but the plaintiff's expert was asked, and he stated, yes, that's evidence of metabolic acidosis. Blood gases should have been drawn, which would have evidenced the high pH, and that would have then led to surgery. So how do we know that Dr. Carter would have taken him to surgery right then, or late that evening, Monday night, early Tuesday morning? Well, we just have to consider what Dr. Carter did once he found metabolic acidosis the next morning at 9 o'clock when he finally made rounds. No nurse had ever called him, but he came in. He saw the blood labs. He saw by that time complete kidney failure. He saw that the patient was completely metabolically acidotic. And in fact, in the medical records, in his consult for that day, he wrote, it was 9 o'clock Tuesday morning that I first understood that we had lost this patient, or that the battle was against us. He needed surgery immediately. He immediately called a general surgeon. However, unfortunately, by 7 a.m. on Tuesday morning, the surgical schedule was set. Dr. Fly has testified to this. Dr. Carter has testified to this. Even the nurses agreed with me that that's about when the surgical schedule was set. The ORs were full. The general surgeons were all busy in cases. So they didn't get a chance to open him until later Tuesday afternoon. And by then the small bowel was almost completely dead, and that's a fatal situation. What's key is that you have 6 to 12 hours to reverse this perfusion problem once you detect metabolic acidosis. The clock is ticking. So timeliness is what this case is all about. We're arguing that they could have gotten to it. Well, when did it start ticking? We're going to argue 9 o'clock Monday night when he started showing evidence of bad tachypnea. That's what the Dr. Carter's general surgery expert, Dr. Hamm, agreed with this, that metabolic acidosis was probably being evidenced after 9 o'clock on Monday night. Of course, our expert says the same thing. They could have got him into surgery sooner rather than later, corrected the blood flow to the small bowel. Another issue that's been brought up. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The other question that they bring up in their appellee's brief is the 50% chance of survival. Our expert has provided an affidavit where he says 50% chance or greater. I believe that's more than a mere scintilla. When I deposed the cardiothoracic surgeon, Dr. Conti, who is the expert for Dr. Carter, he would not agree with me flat out on that, but I had journal articles that I presented to him and quizzed him about during his deposition testimony that suggested a far higher than 50% survival rate for the corrective procedure to repair this type of dissection. And of course he said, oh, I'm not going to agree with that. But my expert will. You know, you take that with the fact that he also had a 6 to 12 hour window, all the experts agree on that, to correct this, and we could have got him into surgery Monday night, you know, 9, maybe 10, maybe 11, maybe 12, far sooner than almost 24 hours later, and that's going to increase the odds of survival.
And all the experts agreed that once this respiratory rate went up, that was an immediate indicator for surgery.
It was immediate need for drawing blood gases, which more likely than not would have showed metabolic acidosis, confirmed it, which then would have been immediate surgery. And Dr. Carter said in his medical record the next day that as soon as I saw metabolic acidosis, that's what it made me take. And his general surgeon expert has said that in his depo, that if he was metabolically acidotic, you start arranging for surgery Monday night.
And does the evidence show at this point what time the last blood gases were drawn before, I guess, Tuesday morning?
Monday morning.
Okay, so it's every 24 hours.
Right.
In this wait-and-watch situation.
Right. They checked it at about 4 in the morning. The next morning, he was acidotic. It also showed by then kidney failure. Likely what was happening, and I'll step aside here, the aorta was dissecting down along. You have your SMA arteries. They go to the small bowel. His small bowel died. That's what killed it. About this far south of those that artery leaving is the renal arteries. It was probably tearing down like this, and it popped off those arteries. Or it could have occluded them due to blood clots. It really was not important for what we're talking about today. But if the kidneys are dying, that tells you that likely the small bowel is dying as well, because it actually departs farther north on the aorta. I would like to address one other thing. Yesterday, a motion was filed by the appellee in this case, trying to narrow the scope of the appeal at requesting time to rebrief or something. And I was traveling, and I didn't get a chance to completely analyze all of this. But I believe what the problem is that may arise here that they would like to highlight is that my notice of appeal identifies some specific rulings that we're appealing from. And they would like to limit me to just those. But I would point out to the court that what I am to understand from people over the phone in my office who have helped me with this is that my notice of appeal said we'll appeal from these items here, comma, and all other ancillary rulings. And so that should encompass everything that I need to talk about in appeal today. And
that motion will remain pending with the court subsequent to submission.
Okay. Should I give you some, is it appropriate for me to give you some case sites?
That would.
All right. I believe there's a case called Perry 272 Southwest 3rd at 586 that basically says a court of appeals should give me leeway on this. Also Vasquez v. Vasquez at 292 Southwest 3rd 80 at 82. And N. Ray Smith, 270 Southwest 3rd, 783 at 787. And I'll reserve any other time that I have remaining for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Ms. Weitenheimer.
That's okay. I'll correct
I'm
you.
Sorry. That's okay. I believe Ashley Weitenheimer, she's a lawyer in our office, and she signed the brief. My name is Wendy Hermes. That's all right. May it please the court. Again, my name is Wendy Hermes. I represent Harris Methodist HEB in this appeal. We respectfully request that this court affirm the ruling of the trial court below granting summary judgment because there is no genuine issue of material fact and because defendant was entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Specifically, with regard to the appeal that we're here today on, Mr. Stewart just referenced his notice of appeal. The notice of appeal specifically states that he is appealing the July 6th, 2010 decision of the trial court, which was the granting of defendant's no evidence motion for summary judgment on one issue, and that is whether or not the plaintiffs were able to provide evidence of causation as it relates to the allegation concerning the nurse's failure to call the doctor regarding the respiratory rate, the tachypnea issue that he mentioned before. To put it in a big picture sense, there's essentially, here's how this happened. The plaintiffs pursued their case for a couple of years against Dr. Carter and Dr. Meltzer, the nephrologist. The hospital was then brought in on the theory only that they should have contacted Dr. Carter that morning when they got the lab results on Tuesday morning. That was their theory against the nurses. We were given summary judgment, granted summary judgment on that by Judge Curry. Plaintiffs then amended their petition to also include a allegation against the nurses for failure to report the rising respiratory rate to Dr. Carter. That allegation is the one that we then moved for a second no evidence summary judgment on, which was granted. Plaintiff's notice of appeal is very clear. Under Rule 25, they are to be held to their notice of appeal and to the allegations, or I'm sorry, to the notice of what they are appealing as set forth in their documents. Attached to their notice of appeal was the order granting summary judgment as to that last no evidence summary judgment only on the respiratory rate issue. So we contend, Your Honors, that is the issue before the court today. Did the plaintiffs bring forth more than a scintilla of evidence to establish that there was causation as it relates to their claims against the nurses concerning respiratory rate? As Your Honors are aware, negligence in a medical malpractice case must be established by an expert. There must be evidence that the negligence claimed was a substantial factor in the harm or injury, and that without such negligence, the harm would not have occurred. That is the evidence that we do not have in this case. If you look at the record, and if we look at what was produced or what was responded to by the plaintiffs in response to our summary judgment, there are two things in the record that they have attached as summary judgment evidence in response to this summary judgment. One, Dr. Fly's deposition. Number two, Dr. Fly's affidavit. This is the first time through all of the summary judgments and the responses back and forth, this is the first time we have an affidavit from Dr. Fly, the plaintiff's expert. We object to the affidavit and did in the trial court below because it's conclusory and is full of speculation. The record at page 695 is where the affidavit begins. And if you go through the affidavit, you can see that essentially plaintiffs are saying that had Dr. Carter been told earlier about the rise in respiratory rate, that he would have done several things. These are all inferences and assumptions as to what Dr. Carter would have done. One, he would have further investigated the matter somehow. He would have discovered the need for surgery. An ABG would have been ordered, a blood gas would have been ordered. The ABG would have shown metabolic acidosis, enough metabolic acidosis to make the doctors immediately take him to surgery. They would have arranged for surgery. They would have had exploratory surgery on Monday night, and the surgery on Monday night would have shown ischemia or infarction. We contend, Your Honor, that as this court pointed out in the Rayon case cited in our brief, that this is merely stacking inference upon inference upon inference. If this happened, then this would have happened. If this happened, then this would have happened. There is no evidence in the record to establish what an ABG would have shown on Monday night. There is no evidence in the record that Dr. Carter would have taken the same steps on Monday night that he took on Tuesday morning.
Why can't the jury infer that? So don't we indulge all inferences on the motion for summary judgment in favor of the non-movement?
We do, Your Honor. However, not in this particular case, and I'll tell you why. A couple reasons. One, I would refer the court to the Supreme Court's recent decision just a few weeks ago in the Jelinek case. That site is 54 Texas Supreme Court Journal 272. That is a case specifically where the Texas Supreme Court analyzed this very question of causation, what is insufficient evidence of causation, and when can we infer causation. In that case, that was a medical malpractice case as well, concerning a hospital's failure to continue a prescription for a patient that was in the hospital suffering from an infection. The bottom line as it relates to Justice Gardner's question is the Supreme Court said very clearly in that case that when the only evidence of a vital fact is circumstantial, which is what we have here because we don't have direct testimony from Dr. Carter as to what he would have done. So when evidence of a vital fact is circumstantial, an expert cannot merely draw inferences and state that they are within reasonable medical probability. He must explain why his inferences are preferable to other inferences that may be drawn from the same record.
Was that a summary judgment?
I do not believe it was a summary judgment.
So
no, ma'am.
Doesn't that make it distinguishable then? An expert report?
There were two parts of that case. I believe it did go to the jury, but there was an expert report consideration as well. There were at least two separate issues on appeal in that case. One was the discussion of insufficient causation, I believe, through the trial court. The second one was the expert report. What I'm discussing right now is not the expert report consideration. I believe that the principles would be the same as they would apply here, which is that an inference must have a reasonable basis behind it. It must have facts in the record to... We object
to the
affidavit as being conclusory in its entirety and therefore being no evidence at all. And as you look through each allegation contained in the affidavit, you can see if you take them one by one, there is no factual basis behind them. Even if we were to allow the inclination that Dr. Carter would have done the same thing that previous evening that he did on Tuesday, and that is the evidence that plaintiffs are offering for causation, clearly, that we know what Dr. Carter did on Tuesday, so therefore he must have most likely done the same thing on Monday night if the nurses had reported the respiratory rate. There's a few other problems with that because there are too many variables in this case to say whether or not Dr. Carter's decision would have been the same. In other words, when Dr. Carter came to see the patient on Tuesday morning, the record shows that there was more going on there than just a rising respiratory rate. There is no expert in this case who has said that, besides Dr. Fly, the plaintiff's expert, that he would have immediately, there is no expert that has said that Dr. Carter would have immediately taken the patient to surgery if he would have known about the rising respiratory rate. What they say is if he had known about the rising respiratory rate, Dr. Fly says he would have investigated it further and he would have done more tests. Those tests would have shown metabolic acidosis enough to make him take the patient to surgery. So by the time he sees him on Tuesday morning, the record shows that there is more going on there than just the rising respiratory rate. Hours had passed. He was able to look at the trend of vital signs. Dr. Carter has multiple consultants at the bedside. He's got a nephrologist, Dr. Meltzer, who he is relying on completely to interpret the laboratories as they relate to kidney function. He's got Dr. Hall, a cardiologist. He's got a neurologist on board, and he has a pulmonologist on board. The record shows from Dr. Carter's deposition, referencing his discharge summary and his interrogatory responses, the record shows that Dr. Carter says that he and the other physicians around him made the decision to go to surgery. There were multiple consultants there, and he was relying upon their input. The discharge summary states that when Dr. Carter came to see the patient, yes, he was acidotic, yes, he was tachypneic, but he also just looked worse to Dr. Carter that morning, and that he was now unresponsive to commands. We have no evidence at all in the record that those things were present on Monday night before, and therefore we have no evidence in the record that Dr. Carter would have taken the same steps that he did the morning before. I would refer the court to the Bryant versus Levy case out of Amarillo, which is 196 Southwest 3rd, 166. Very similar to this case here, where in that particular case, a baby had come into the emergency room with what turned out to be a pneumothorax, which is a collapsed lung. The plaintiffs in that case brought forth expert testimony that if the emergency room doctor had taken an x-ray earlier, he would have found a pneumothorax. They then could have instigated various treatment modalities and that the baby would have survived. That court held that that was insufficient because there was no background evidence as to why a pneumothorax would have shown up on that initial x-ray. Here, there is no evidence in the record as to what those ABGs would have shown. There is no evidence in the record as to what further investigation Dr. Carter would have done. It's stacking inference upon inference, and according to the court in the Archer case, also cited in our brief, if an opinion is based upon assumed facts, it cannot support a judgment. Specifically, with regard to the assumptions that are being made, I've mentioned several of them. We would also point the court to the Havner case, cited in our brief as well, where an expert saying that someone could have done something isn't sufficient to establish causation.
But the problem is you're not relying on summary judgment cases. None of those are summary judgment cases. And this is a summary judgment. So we have to infer all facts and inferences in favor of the non-movement and view them in the light most favorable to the non-movement, which totally doesn't apply in expert report cases or in cases that have gone to a jury when you have expert testimony.
Mm-hmm.
The jury then resolves those credibility issues and those inference issues.
And I agree, Your Honor. However, what I would say to that is that there still must be some type of factual basis for the inference. And in this case, there is nothing other than the blanket testimony of Dr. Fly as to what he believes Dr. Carter would have done, and that there is nothing.
But you objected on that basis to his affidavit, and the trial court overruled your objections, and you don't have any kind of a cross point claiming that that ruling was an error. So how do we get around that we are to take Dr. Fly's affidavit as it appears in the record?
Okay, well, let me do it this way. There's two issues with Dr. Fly's affidavit. Again, we're just focusing now on that last summary judgment and the court's granting of that last summary judgment. One is the issue regarding the inferences, which I contend there still is no – there's not a reasonable inference being made because there is nothing at all to back it up. Even if there were, though, let's say that – that it was a valid inference. There's a second problem with Dr. Fly's affidavit, and that is that plaintiffs cannot get around that there is no evidence other than conclusory statements in the affidavit concerning the 51% survival. This is very similar to the case of Hodgkins versus Levy, as well as the Arredondo case out of San Antonio, where in those expert reports, they also affidavits, they also stated that these are medical malpractice cases, and the expert stated in a sentence, like in the record on page 695, where Dr. Fly does, that there is a 51% or greater chance of survival based on reasonable medical probability. And that is the whole discussion that we have. Those cases that I just referenced analyze that as well. That is a conclusory statement with no foundation in the record. There is no study, no scientific evidence, no journals to back it up. There is no evidence provided by the plaintiffs to overcome summary judgment with regard to that issue. There is no evidence that Mr. McDonald more than likely would have survived even if the nurses had reported this respiratory rate earlier. I see that my time has almost expired, so thank you very much for your time, and we respectfully request that you affirm the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Herman.
Thank you.
Mr. Stewart.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's probably not necessary for me to even rebut anything, but I did want to point out that on page 10 of my brief at the bottom, there's a sentence begins about Dr. Carter and what he was thinking on Tuesday morning when he arrived at 9. His I'm sorry, it's at the bottom of page 11. And it starts at the top of 12, is that direct quote. At 9 that morning, he says, I thought we started infarcting on the 26th, the morning of the 26th. That's Tuesday morning. And he's referring to the early morning hours after midnight. Infarcting means a complete stop of blood to the organ. And that's when you really start having bowel necrosis and ischemia. He says, I did not order another study. I ordered the operating room to get ready. So it may be that the evidence shows that he wouldn't have even ordered a blood gas at 9 the previous evening if he had obvious evidence of metabolic acidosis. That's at least some inference in the record that he may have just ordered the operating room to get ready anyway as soon as he saw evidence of metabolic acidosis.
He was talking about the lab values, though, wasn't he, in his deposition? Maybe I'm looking at a statement that you made after the quote from the record on page 11.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not able to follow.
Okay. Never
mind. It is true that he had lots of other evidence that morning because he was physically looking at the patient at 9 in the morning on Tuesday. But had he been called Monday night, he could also have traveled to the hospital and eyeballed the patient himself and seen the tachypnea for himself, too.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Thank you, Ms. Hermes. We appreciate your arguments today. And your briefing, your case is submitted, and you are excused.
Thank you.